Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK.
I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Khan.
This week, Hamza Yousaf's shock defenestration.
We'll be joined by Politico's Andrew McDonald to unpick how it all went dramatically wrong.
We'll also discuss Britain's broken care system with Lem Sisse and Rebecca Pierre.
Plus, find out if the left are starting to hold more sway over our political narratives. Hi, Nish. How are you? What have you been up to?
The usual, Coco. Yeah, sitting around my house, staring into space.
Contemplating your own mortality.
What have you been up to?
Do you know what? I'm actually in a tremendously good mood.
Why?
I feel like spring is finally here. The birds are chirping. The sun is out. Street harassment has begun.
Oh, has it?
Oh, it's street harassment
season.
Oh, yes. And that's how you know it's spring. Oh, my God. Okay, so I have to tell you about this, my latest bit of street harassment. It's been some time. So I was walking down the street and this guy comes up to me and he's like, excuse me, miss, are you married?
Here we go.
And I said...
What an opening gambit.
Well, that is weird because anyway, I digress. Man comes up to me and he says, excuse me, miss, are you married? And I say, yes. And he says... Wow, how could your husband let you go out with hair like that?
What?
Right, so I was like, I stomped off angrily, being like, how dare you insult my hair, you reprobate and ruffian. That's what I said in my mind, obviously. Yeah. I just went. And then I met up with a friend and she said, no, what he's saying is your hair's so good, how could you be let out of the house with hair like this?
Right, okay.
Because, you see what I mean? It's very much the blue dress, gold dress of street harassment.
I would say it's too abstract.
Yeah.
If I was trying to critique this man's street harassment, I would say it's too abstract.
Okay.
I don't think you should have to sift through the wreckage of a compliment looking for the black box recorder of its original intent.
Okay, well, there you go. If you're listening, gentlemen that approach me in Barking Market, needs improvement. Definitely needs improvement. I know you said you had a chill one.
Listen, I watched the film Challengers. I had to have a cold shower afterwards. That's the end of my film review.
You didn't find yourself popping any... political popcorn?
Nothing got popped. A lot of things got popped in that movie. Let's just put it that way.
I mean,
it's one of the horniest films I've ever seen. If you go and see Challengers, okay. I would recommend having a quiet moment with yourself afterwards. It's one of the horniest movies I've ever seen.
I meant about the potential election news and the idea that you might be celebrating in your home. But well, thank you for that image.
Yes, I mean, I guess there is an element of celebration to it. I don't know what. It was just another... absolutely chaotic weekend.
Right. So for any of our friends who aren't completely wired into the news, over the weekend from Friday afternoon, the rumour mill went into overdrive, essentially saying that an election was going to be called on Monday. The suggestion was that the Tories would want to get ahead of this supposed wipeout that's coming on Thursday. It did turn out to be an incorrect rumour, though.
In many ways, it was a sort of crackpot theory because it doesn't make any sense to call an election... happen imminently when the first week of the news cycle in that election was likely to conclude with a bollocking in the media because of bad local election results. There is a suggestion made by The Guardian that this rumour was started by the Labour Party, essentially, to kind of make it look like Sunak had backed out of something that he hadn't actually called in the first place. Did you think it was going to happen?
I mean, to be honest, I lose all my critical faculties when someone says there might be an election because I'm so excited and I want it so much. And a rumour like this hasn't appealed to me as much as that time that Avril Lavigne had a body double. Like, it's really gotten to me. It's captivated me.
So no one's really clear on where this rumour started.
No.
And no one's really clear if it was the Conservatives trying to punish the Conservative Party or the Conservative Party trying to punish itself. But the conclusion everyone has come to is the Conservative Party is fucked. That seems to be... the sort of conclusion of all of the conversations around this.
It is funny, isn't it? Because it seems that like there was a political purpose for both Labour and the Conservatives, but not for me. I feel very I won nothing over the weekend with this, so that's great.
I have to say, like, there is this element of, obviously, we want an election, there's an excitement about it. I am at a kind of tipping point with this whole thing, where I just want this parliament cycle to end. Because at the moment, we are living in a constant theatre of rumours and counter-rumours. Because ever since Sunak has come to power, the speculation has purely been based on when there is going to be a general election. And his government has, from day one, effectively been a lame duck administration with the kind of sort of faint memory of power within it, but no actual ability to enact any kind of policy. And the country is facing a crisis at the moment. It's facing about five different interlocking related crises at the minute. And also internationally, the situation in Gaza is a crisis. The situation in Ukraine is a crisis. We don't have a functioning government. The fact that the government can control the date of the election to act solely in its own interest is a farce. I think possibly the only good thing that came out of David Cameron's coalition government was that they at least implemented the Fixed Term Parliament Act, though this was then later repealed by Boris Johnson. Because at this point, we don't have a government. They aren't able to legislate on anything. The only thing they can do is quell rumours of an election that they themselves may or may not have started. It has to end. We desperately, desperately, desperately need to have an election because we need a functioning government and not one that is only able to firefight problems it started for itself.
No, absolutely. And I mean, we're not the only ones who think that. Even sitting MPs think that. There was a defection this weekend, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. A top Tory MP has defected to the Labour Party. So this is Dan Poulter, who's the MP for Central Suffolk and North Ipswich. He said the Conservatives have become a nationalist party of the right that has abandoned compassion. Dan, where have you been getting your news for the last 14 years? Where have you been getting your... I mean...
You know, better late than never.
Better late than never? How fucking late is it possible to be? Where have you been getting your information from for the last 14 years? That it's come to my attention that the Conservative Party has become a nationalist party of the right and abandoned compassion. Well, the party that brought you austerity, the Windrush scandal, the mismanagement of COVID.
Look, I'm saying better late than never, but that's being far too generous. This man helped push through David Cameron's private sector-friendly health and social care bill. I mean, how can you say that you care about the NHS if you agree to that sort of thing? And I think what's more interesting about it is not so much this man's rights and wrongs, but it's more about, you know, how does the Labour Party see themselves? This guy calls himself a centrist. They're happy to have him. What does that tell us about the Labour Party?
I can understand why Labour are happy about this, only because he did 20 night shifts over the last year and described doing them in an overstretched A&E department as truly life-changing. And he said that persuaded him to defect, as he said that he believes the Labour Party is the only one committed to investing in improving the NHS. And he'll sit on the Labour benches until the next general election. But where I also agree with you that I'm not sure how big a cause this is for celebration is that he's announced that he's stepping down. So he's essentially sitting with Labour for about 5 minutes and then he's fucking off.
And of course, the popcorn wasn't just out for the Tories this week.
To my wonderful wife, my beautiful children, and my wider family for putting up with me over the years, I'm afraid you'll be seeing a lot more of me from now. You are truly everything to me. And although, of course, as you can tell, I'm sad that my time as First Minister is ending, but I am so grateful, I'm so blessed for having the opportunity that are afforded to so few to lead my country. And who could ask for a better country to lead than Scotland? Thank you very much.
A clip there from the shock political news from the past Monday, Humza Yousaf resigning from his role as Scotland's First Minister after a disastrous week of mostly self-inflicted wounds.
To dig into how on earth this all happened over just a few days, we're here with Andrew McDonald from Politico. Hello. Been a busy few days, hey?
It has, yeah. It's just escalated.
The unfolding of events has been warp speed, and it's been sort of incredibly dramatic unravelling of the leader of a nation. So to properly understand it, we need to dig into how we got here, which begins with the coalition between the SNPs and the Scottish Green Party, known as the Bute House Agreement.
So let's wind the clock back to when Nicola Sturgeon was First Minister, when she forged this deal to form a minority government following the May 2021 Scottish Parliament election. Here's Sturgeon speaking after the agreement.
Our parties will, of course, retain our distinctive identities. This is not a coalition, and we do not agree on everything, but we are coming out of our comfort zones to focus on what we do agree on. Despite all of the risks inherent in any decision of two parties to cooperate more closely, we are choosing to work together. And we are doing so not out of political necessity, but for the common good.
So two specific issues sunk the Bute House agreement, and it ended up causing some friction between the parties. Firstly, a rollback on climate commitments, and secondly, NHS Scotland implementing a pause on prescriptions for puberty blockers for children. That was recommended by the paediatrician Hilary Cass following her controversial review into gender identity services for young people. So Andrew, can you just clarify what happened on both of these issues?
Yeah, so on the climate targets, Scotland under Nicola Sturgeon committed to this target of cutting 75% of carbon emissions by 2030. Now, this was an ambitious target. It was a stretch target, and it was a fair bit more ambitious than the UK government's own target. But in the last couple of years, in particular the last few months, it started to become quite clear that this wasn't a particularly realistic target. So they began to brief that they were dropping these targets 2 weeks ago, and then they dropped it on Thursday.
Right. And so what happened with the Cass review recommendations? Was that a sort of similar pathway?
Yeah, it was. You have to go back a little bit with this one to the Scottish government trying to reform the process behind gender recognition to make it simpler for trans people to change gender. Now, as we know, this was blocked by the UK government after the Scottish Parliament passed it, and then went to Supreme Court challenge on that decision, which in the Supreme Court upheld the UK government's veto. And at that point, the Scottish government decided not to appeal. And that annoyed plenty of Green Party members, but they held their tongue at the time. And then we've seen this review by Dr. Hilary Cass, and what we saw then was two very different responses to that review from the two parties of the Scottish government. While Humza Yousaf said, "We'll look at what Dr. Cass has said and consider her recommendations," Patrick Harvey did an interview with the BBC after the report came out where he said it was unscientific.
So, Andrew, in terms of this partnership, the Bute House Agreement, it was never a coalition. And is there a sense that it was only really held together because of the sort of force of personality of Nicola Sturgeon and what a kind of colossal figure she is in Scottish politics? And was it always destined to kind of unravel without her? Or is there some other reason why this is kind of blown up in Humza Yousaf's face?
So I think Nicola Sturgeon certainly could hold a lot of things together that not many politicians can. And as you say, it was not a coalition, but I think a problem for both Nicola Sturgeon and for Humza Yousaf was that it came to be described as a coalition.
Yeah.
And both parties have always thought it was unfair that, you know, people like me and in the media would describe it as a coalition. But at the end of the day, they had two ministers. They had a direct say in the policy prospectus of the Scottish government. If it's not a coalition, it's something very, very close to a coalition. In terms of whether it was always destined to unravel, in the last year, Humza Yousaf started to chart a slightly different path to Nicola Sturgeon on policy. And the big moment, which really sort of kicked off these grumbles in the Scottish Greens membership, was in October last year at the SNP conference when Humza Yousaf surprised us all by announcing a freeze on council tax.
Right.
And that's very unpopular with Scottish Greens. That was the sort of start of a slight shift from Humza Yousaf away from maybe the Sturgeon agenda of focusing on public services and socially liberal policies.
So the way all of this shook out is substantially different to the situation following the Tory Liberal Democrat coalition back in 2010. And that was interesting because in the end, the Liberal Democrats kind of rolled over on a number of their principles to get this alternative vote election. It didn't sort of work out very well for them. But this is almost the inverse, right?
Yes, they ended up wielding a lot of power. And ultimately, the Greens were able to have a pretty big impact on the Scottish government's agenda.
Do you think ultimately this was a case of political miscalculation on Humza Yousaf's part, or was he given an impossible job? Because I do have the sense, and I have varying levels of sympathy for Humza Yousaf and Rishi Sunak, as people can imagine, because of shared values, I would say. But I do have this slight sense that the SNP and the Conservative Party have gone, let's give it to the Asian while things are in the toilet. Like, there is that, I have that slight sense, to the extent that I think Manchester United should name me their next manager, just because, just to follow the system of giving bloated, collapsing regimes to an Asian man to handle. Do you think that this was a miscalculation, or was he in an impossible job? Or is it both?
It's definitely a bit of both. I think the direct circumstances that led to him having to resign on Monday, with no one having expected that to come 3 days earlier, is complete political miscalculation from him.
Yeah.
He decided on Wednesday night that he was going to ditch the Greens. What he clearly did not do was work out the ramifications of pissing off your coalition partners will result in them deciding they want to get rid of you.
Yeah.
And there's this word that people have used a lot in the last few days, right, in conversations with me. It's wargaming. That is what is important for politicians, that you get a flowchart out. You write, I get rid of the Greens, what next? I think just there was a lack of foresight into what was going to happen next, and the fact that, right, if I get rid of the Greens, the Scottish Tories could then force a vote of no confidence in me. Am I certain that if I get rid of the Greens, they will not vote for that Tory motion?
For the sort of immediate future, there's been a few names thrown up as the potential next first minister. As of now on Wednesday morning, where are we with the most likely front runner?
No one has declared as of Wednesday morning where we are right now, but we have John Swinney, the former SNP deputy first minister and actually former SNP leader back in 2004 when I was quite literally 5 years old. John Swinney led the SNP for a few months and then was forced out by what became known as the men in grey kilts, who decided his leadership wasn't cutting the mustard.
So you'll have to please elaborate on men in grey kilts. That's not something I think everyone's familiar with.
So I think in UK politics, I think there's this phrase of the men in grey suits who used to decide the fate of failing Tory leaders in the past. And some very creative journalists and senior SNP sources in the early 2000s decided to come up with their own version of.
And that's why they get the big money niche. It's because of that witty and tundras of the press. Anyway, sorry.
Go. I'm just dealing with the revelation that you were five in 2004. I think everyone, there'd be a lot of people listening going, fucking hell.
So yes, John Swinney is seen, and people tell me he is basically this figure who can unite the SNP.
He is the
safe pair of hands, the candidate who can unite the SNP in its most difficult moment, I think, who can, like, you know, take them through a very difficult Westminster election for them. Mm. Stemming the bleeding was the phrase I heard yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so even if the SNP can settle this leadership crisis, it sounds like it's very important. I think we should all be paying strong attention to it. On Wednesday, the government faced a vote of no confidence tabled by Labour and narrowly defeated through the support of the Greens. So in whose interest would it be to blow up the Scottish government? Like, when presumably whatever happens is going to be a substantially disempowered SNP.
Scottish Labour.
Right.
Yeah. Scottish Labour would love an election right now because they are probably the only party who would really stand to gain and who have a realistic chance of replacing the SNP in the Scottish government. I wouldn't say it's a universal position within Scottish Labour. I've talked to a few people who think maybe they're not quite ready and maybe a few months more, maybe that timing might work better. But at the same time, given we've had every news bulletin being focused on chaos within the SNP, I think they would still very much like an election right now with that in people's minds.
Andrew McDonald, thank you so much for joining us on the couch today. Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Aura Frames.
If you're looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the mums in your life, then Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos.
It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalise the frame with preloaded photos and memories.
We know because we've done it ourselves for our own mothers. And yes, it was a success. So from grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, everyone loves an Aura frame.
Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favourite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to mums of all ages. They certainly have brought joy to Coco and my mothers. It's the perfect present.
Yeah. I mean, it is a little bit feeding the beast, though, because every time I see my mum now, she's like, New photo? Refresh? Is it time to refresh this? But anyway, right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day.
Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame.
That's auraframes.com, A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use the code PSUK at the checkout to save.
Terms and conditions apply.
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
So we want to help bring some deserved attention to an issue that's not talked about nearly enough here in the UK, and that is the youth care system. So this is the system that concerns children and young people living under the care of their local authority, including in fostering and independent living arrangements.
It's a system that's hugely complicated and difficult for the young people experiencing care, and care leavers are some of the most disadvantaged people in our society.
So joining us on the Pod Save the UK sofa now are social worker and journalist Rebecca Pierre and activist and poet Lem Sisse. You've both collaborated together on a new collection of essays, poetry and letters. It's called Free Loaves on Fridays.
A bigotry wave.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
For the listeners, Rebecca just waved the book.
Welcome, Rebecca and Lem.
Thank you. It's honestly such a pleasure to be here. And just thank you for spotlighting this issue. It's just so, as you know, glossed over, and everyone from, you know, Parliament to the press look the other way. And so it means a lot to have this space.
And is that the impulse of putting the book together, presumably, to try and get it foregrounded like this?
It is. Well, to be real with you, it was never my idea. As these things aren't, I wrote an article for The Guardian a couple of years ago about care. And an editor got in touch and said, hey, would you like to write about, put an anthology together? And between us, my response was absolutely not. Because in my mind, an anthology was a limited selection. And I could not get my head around the concept of rejecting, you know, people coming with their stories from care, because that is, you know, a community where there's so much rejection. So it's the first mainstream anthology known really to have a no rejection policy. So we've got 100 stories from people aged 13 to 68. And I'm just so, so happy. We've got the brilliant Lem part of it as well.
And I'm really honoured to be in this book as somebody who was in care myself. But also, this idea of having a no rejection policy, it makes one think, you know, could the quality not work?
Yeah,
sure.
You know, but actually it does, it really does. This book is a beautiful testament to the true experiences of young people who are in institutions and in foster care around the country.
You've taken sort of great care to platform the voices of care leavers themselves. What does that bring to the conversation, and how do you guys hope that that would inspire change?
Well, from my personal experience, care leavers are often written about, but very rarely with. So I know both of us have accessed our care files, and I requested mine 2 summers ago. And honestly, I think to see myself written about, and I'm a social worker too, so I know how hard it is to write case notes with so little respect and accuracy was really hard. So this is about flipping the narrative and say, hey, hang on, we're not just protagonists, we can be the authors of our own narrative as well. So it's about breaking stereotypes, educating and informing the public who we are and what we're about.
It is a horrible facet of our media that this is not the only subject where you see people talking about a group of people and you never hear from them. You know, trans people, refugees, sex workers, all of them. It's very radical to put those voices front and centre. And I wondered when I was reading your piece, particularly Rebecca, and I know Lem, you've done the same, about opening your record. To what extent do you think that's required? Because there's a disbelief from people, i.e. you have to have the record to say, believe me when I say this happened.
It's a huge question, actually. One of my case notes, well, the word alleged comes up all the time. And if I asked you to think about getting deep here, I've only met you 5 minutes ago, but one of the most, you know, traumatic things that's happened to you in the last 5 or 10 years, and suddenly you're opening up to authority and that's described as an allegation. It hurts and it's heartbreaking and there is a narrative of disbelief. And I think, honestly, when I think about my care records, as a social worker myself, I almost have a level of pity for the social worker who wrote them, because she didn't think in a million years that, you know, a teenage kid from Blackpool with all this baggage and trauma would ever grow up to have the wherewithal or the education or the power to know how to access those records.
So you're recognising the power in those individuals, and also the power of the witness statement, man. These are witness statements from people to say, this happened to me in my childhood. It may be horrific, but I can walk with it. They're not all horror stories, by the way, but they are. I believe that writing is a kind of witness statement, a creative witness statement. And I've never seen a book like this.
What you're saying makes me think about those very people. We've got people here who have never had any GCSEs, who, you know...
That's me.
That's this is exactly who we need to hear from. It's not the polished publishing, you know, the Oxbridge. Sorry, Fida, if you went to Oxbridge.
We did not.
But it's the real people who have been in prison or who have been excluded.
I want to talk about policy. We've had a comment from a listener, Stephen Farrar, who said, it just seems a no-brainer for our society to invest in children who will contribute, much as what you guys are just saying about the diversity, the backgrounds of people who go on to do amazing things from care. It seems a no-brainer for our society to invest in children who will contribute back to that society over their lifetime. We all know from our own families how childhood trauma can affect many generations. Most of us can recover with the right support, but what if there's no one there to help us? It's really important that we all feel loved and secure to become fully functioning members of society. This makes economic sense and improves the functioning of society. How is the care system currently funded, and what do you feel needs to change in that area?
I'm so glad you brought this up, because as a social worker, I have witnessed the devastating impact of austerity, you know, over the last 13 years. So it is centrally funded. However, that is, you know, local authorities have discretion. But actually, last week, a report came out to say that 51% of local authorities are possibly having to think about submitting a Section 114 notice in the next 5 years, which, for listeners who don't know, that's declaring bankruptcy.
Yeah.
51%. And at the same time, that just leaves the gates wide open for privatisation. So care is very lucrative. Last year, you know, £1.63 billion was made in this sector, £300 million of profit. And when you think £300 million of profit, made in the sector, and yet the Independent Care Review that asked for £2.6 billion from the government.
Josh McAllister,
you know, he asked for £2.6 billion and only got £200 million. That's nothing. That's that's two-thirds of, you know, what private companies are profiting. And I know I've lived in unregulated placement as a teenager, and in some of those placements, the charge is £7,000 per week per teenager. Now, 3 weeks in care in, you know, a crap hostel in the middle of nowhere should not equate to 3 years at university. I'm going to stop now because I'd go on my high horse.
We actually should brief people beforehand. This is a safe space for your high horse riding.
It is mad though, just hearing those numbers, because it really speaks to the madness of privatisation, because, you know, £300 million left in profit. Imagine what could be done if that stayed in and was reinvested. How many lives of children could have been helped?
And not just offshore investors.
We want to draw attention to the problems, but also to the solutions. So the McAllister review you just referred to, it was a review in an independent report into children's social care, and it recommended some pretty substantial revisions to funding and management of care. So this is the author, Josh McAllister, speaking to Sky's Kay Burley back in May 2022.
Over 5 years, we're calling for £2.6 billion to be injected into the system.
Where's that going to come from?
Well, the issue is, if we don't actually bring about some major change in the system. We'll be on track to have 100,000 children in care by 2032, and that will cost us £15 billion a year. So the choice for the government here, and for all of us, frankly, is do we keep pouring money into a system that's faltering and letting down too many of the most vulnerable, and it will get worse and more expensive, or do we actually take some bold action now, smart, and invest and change that?
You called the McAllister review the best review of children's social care.
Yes.
But also you said the government has disappointingly cherry-picked from the recommendations. What do you commend about the review, and what do you think needs to be enacted from it that the government is avoiding talking about?
Well, the first thing to commend about the review on behalf of the government, even, is that that $2.6 billion that Josh McAllister was saying that needed to be spent was saving about $5 billion. So whenever you hear the numbers that he's mentioning, he specifically designed the answers to a failing care system to look after the child that comes into the care system and also to save money for the government. But it means that the government would have to think in long term.
The review was saying, actually, we can do more preventative work, early intervention, so not just leave it till crisis point, then children going into care and, you know, these extortionate kind of fees coming up. So part of it was there. But also, if a child is prevented from going into care, it's also the long-term, you know, prevention of homelessness, prevention of, you know, criminal justice system, yes, and all the thousands that goes into, you know, the upkeep of people in that system and so on.
He was talking about the quality of care that they get when they're in care as well, because I think one of the things that Josh was saying is a child can go into the care system and then the system can exacerbate the problems that the child may have been going through. They came from a traumatic situation, they're leaving their parents, they come into care and they're moved, for example, from one foster parent to another. I think the average amount of moves over 10 years is 5 times for a kid in care.
I've not heard that.
He was wanting for fostering to be a better solution that doesn't actually make the child need more services from the care system and therefore save money. Why is it that when a child goes into care, the problems begin?
Yeah.
It's called care. The problems are supposed to end there. When they enter care, that is supposed to be our government saying this is the most vulnerable person in our society. It is a child without family who's in distress and previously traumatised.
Well, as you say, I mean, you outline in your introduction in the book, Rebecca, you know, you talk about all these failing systems and how they kind of coalesce around this problem. And by the time the child's taken into care, there were already loads of failures, weren't there? There was failures in access to mental health. There was failures in terms of potentially domestic violence services. A thing that I found really hard-hitting is when you talked about property prices and the impact of that. And so, you know, children are moved to the northeast because the property is cheaper there. I mean, that can be hundreds of miles away from their neighbourhoods, their communities, their friendship circles. I suppose this is a really long way of saying, to what extent can this actually be resolved or improved by the next Labour government? Or do you think actually it's going to take lots of input? It's going to take successive governments? What do you think? Where are we?
Well, firstly, it absolutely needs cross-party political ambition and not for government to just lay waste to the care system and feed it to, you know, privatisation. But going back to what you said about children going miles away. So I'm from Blackpool, and a report came out from the APPG, the Child of the North report last week, that said one in 52 children in Blackpool are in care. Wow. Now, if you just take a moment to sit with that figure, one in 52, and I'm from Blackpool, you know, I have a big heart, a big love for that town, but I know there is a huge amount of poverty, of, you know, unemployment, that there's nothing for young people, homelessness. And we know there is a link between poverty and children going into care. So also it's about the government not just wanting to fix the care system, but holistically looking at, okay, are we investing in early years, sure start, health, schools, and eradicate poverty, which is something this government has no interest in my opinion.
You might remember that two previous guests on the show are Labour's Jess Phillips and Beth Rigby from Sky News, and we'd love to tell you more about their podcast, Electoral Dysfunction.
Electoral Dysfunction is a new weekly show hosted by three big names in politics. So that's Beth and Jess, alongside the Tory peer, Ruth Davidson.
It offers a refreshing, intelligent and entertaining take on politics by three female voices known for cutting through the BS of Westminster.
And they'll be exploring some of the bigger questions beyond the polls. At a time when trust seems broken and in a record year for elections around the world, they're going to ask, how can we get politics working again?
Featuring a current Member of Parliament, a former party leader and an award-winning journalist with decades of experience between them, they give you an unvarnished take on the week in Westminster and beyond.
Follow Electoral Dysfunction now, wherever you're listening to this. New episodes drop every Friday.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
So I think it's important to say that in this collection of stories, there are a lot of uplifting stories. Mm-hmm. You know, you really can get a sense of like when the system's done well, it's Absolutely. Amazing and something to be proud of. But there's no denying that a lot of it is painful reading and it's traumatic.
Huge question. Well, like a protective sibling, really, I am the first to criticise the system because I lived through it. And also I've been a social worker, seeing the reality of that. Like many people from care, I went back to the system to fix it and then found that's not possible because it's desperately underfunded. When it comes to the state role, I mean, we hear the term corporate parent bandied about a lot. It's something that I personally hate. And the first time I heard it in a local authority office, I honestly thought it was a joke.
I have not heard that. Wait, so what is that?
What does it mean, corporate parent, as an idea?
So it's the idea that the state is acting in loco parentis. But yes, they have the legal duty of a parent to a child. So any child who's in the care system has the state as their corporate parent. The state does have a role, absolutely, not only to respond to the trauma that children faced pre-care, but also whilst and after they leave care as well. But we know that at the moment, in some local authorities, there are waiting lists for up to 4 years for children and adults' mental health services, which, quite frankly, is a disgrace because some children will have literally aged out of the system by the time they get help. So, to your question, how bad can it get? I could sit here and talk about the statistics, which are hugely depressing, but it manifests in many ways. It manifests in a lack of opportunities. So there was once an erroneous statistic going around that said children from care are more likely to end up in prison than university. Thankfully, that isn't true and it has been disputed. However, there is some truth in that, you know, it's easier to get into the criminal justice system than it is to university. I know that firsthand. When I lived in an unregulated accommodation, which was a bed sit with 16 to 25 year olds, you know, just to be real with you, I probably shouldn't be saying this on the podcast, but I used to shoplift from Primark and Tesco just to get by all the time. And really, I don't have a criminal record because I was lucky, but it was so much easier. I was drawn into that life to survive than it was to study for A-levels in a dark room where, you know, this is only in 2011. I'd do my coursework with a pen in one hand and a candle in the other, which just sounds Victorian. So it can manifest in many ways. And unfortunately, without early intervention, without investment in mental health services, it's going to get worse.
Well, the reason I ask that is because, you know, in that clip, Kay Burley very quickly retorts, where are you going to get the money for that? And I often think to myself, what is the price of trauma? What is the actual...
What a question.
You know, and I think this is... I sometimes get very frustrated when everything boils down to money, but I think we can all agree we're walking around in a society at the moment where it's not nice. Mm. You know, there's a lot of people suffering. Yeah, you have an example in your introduction where you talk about a company that was offering care to, you know, young people and then realised it was more profitable to pivot. So they just closed it down and just made them all homeless. And they can do that.
Absolutely. When they've got no personal investment, it's not like a local authority homegrown organisation that is deeply invested in caring for the children in its locality.
I was just going to ask you what it was like to reflect on your own diary entries, because your chapter is a kind of collage of you writing now, your actual case files, which you talked about, you both have had access to, and then also your teenage diary at the time. And what is that like? How hard is that to be sort of confronted by your own, by yourself as a younger person who's going through it at the time?
It's a huge question. And to be real with you, I had to have art therapy throughout this process because it was really hard. I mean, the first part of me thinks, oh my goodness, if my teenage self knew I was, you know, airing my emo teenage diaries, I think she'd be quite frankly horrified.
I mean, you come across very articulate.
Yeah.
I mean, my 16-year-old diaries would be like, woo, Radiohead. I hate him. He's such a jerk. I'd be like that. That'd be my like rotation of anxieties about school or whatever. But, you came across incredibly compassionate, thoughtful, self-aware, like, yeah.
But there was totally that as well, though. There was like the bitty school dinner arguments and, you know, my crush at the time who was ignoring me and all that, which thank God you won't see in the book because you'd pay not to read that. but thinking about it was incredibly hard. And the only reason I actually went to the diary entries was because a few years ago I was writing a journal paper on the harms of unregulated care. And I thought, where best to go then to my own experiences? So I dug out my little shoebox, which had, you know, diary entries going back to teenage years. And I found one. And honestly, the heartbreak and the despair really struck with me because those, you know, you forget what it's like, don't you? So it was incredibly hard. And I had to take breaks many times. But I also felt it was important for teenage Becca to have a voice because she can speak to the authentic experience way more than I can now. You know, in a relatively privileged position, I'm not having to, you know, live in a bedsit with no electricity and skip meals and all of that now. So she's closer to the truth than I am.
One of the most critical elements of the McAllister Review was the recommendation that care experience should become a protected characteristic. On the show earlier this year, we profiled Terry Galloway as our Hero of the Week for his work campaigning on this exact issue. But could you remind us of what that means?
There is a prejudice against a person who's in care or has been in care. That prejudice means they may not get a house or a flat when they apply to get a flat. That prejudice might mean even that a hospital won't do certain operations because you haven't got the family who will look after you after the operations. Yes. It may mean that the police will look at you as an actual problem because you've been brought up in care and you're from care. It may be that a person in a job doesn't want to employ you because they think that children in care are naughty kids. And this is an experience that children in care who become adults have to come through all the time. Mm. And the proof of it is, for example, in prisons. You know, the amount of people who've been in care between the ages of 18 and 25 is off the scale.
Yeah.
So to protect your characteristic of being in care means that society will defend that person against the housing officer who doesn't want to put them into a flat, against the police who immediately may feel that this person's a little bit tricky because they've been in care, against a social worker who may think, oh, that family's a bad family. They've obviously got people in care that meet, you know. By the way, there are people who think that if you're worth less, if you're worth less money, you are less. And the protected characteristic says that is not right. You are not less than a person who has got a family if you've been in care, and that we as a society will protect you.
Yeah, so, so important. And I think it's a brilliant recommendation in putting those ring fences around, but it isn't a silver bullet. Mm. You know, it needs to be protected characteristics and ring-fenced funding for this group, because without that, it's a label that local authorities can opt in or out of ultimately.
I mean, what Terry's doing is getting all of the local authorities to to say we want to sign up to a protected characteristic. And he's got, I think, about 90 local authorities around the country at the moment.
So impressive.
This is a really big deal. I've never seen in my lifetime of the children in care rights movement, I've never seen this kind of like above the crease activity. And it's very exciting. And if Labour get in, it would be wonderful if they took on the what they're all of the councils around the country are taking on, which is the protected characteristic.
So between the findings of the review and this protected characteristic idea, there are solutions out there, and it absolutely is a
and
way
book,
through this.
You know, starting the conversation off, kicking, like, you know, taking it further. It's nice to end such a painful section on something hopeful. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for joining us, Rebecca and Lem. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
To be here.
So, Nish, since we last spoke, something surprising, should we say, has happened in your life. It's quite well-timed, actually, because we normally have a PSUK hero and villain around this time in the show. And I think this may be the hero we did not need and the villain we never saw coming. It's you as James Bond. Please explain.
So, a few weeks ago, I did an interview with The Guardian, your habitual employer, and I was asked a question about the fact that James Acaster is in the new Ghostbusters movie, which he is, which is very funny and very exciting for us. It makes me laugh that in the interview it's reported he's described as my colleague, which I really enjoyed. And now I only refer to him as my colleague, James Acaster. Not clear what office he and I are working in. The office of human laughter. The interviewer asked me if there was a film franchise I would be interested in participating in the way that Acaster has been with Ghostbusters. And I said that I thought it would be funny if I was made James Bond because of the collective meltdown it would inspire in a certain section of the British media and British society. And I thought that it would be a funny prank for Barbara Broccoli to play. And I think I said something like, they've made enough money out of James Bond. Now they should purely be hiring on a prank basis. And I thought that that would be funny. And the interview has just come out this week. And obviously, you know, sometimes you do an interview and you think, I don't remember saying anything like that. I read it and I was like, yeah, I said every word of that. I'm available if the Bond producers want to hire me purely as a prank. I think it would be extremely funny. Obviously, what then happened was that that interview was posted this week on The Guardian's website and it was in the paper. And then people had an absolute meltdown about it.
Right on cue.
People on the internet with more time on their hands than common sense, I think just genuinely thought that I was applying for the job of James Bond, which I think is very funny.
There was definitely a lot of grumbling about this idea that you were self-nominating yourself for this prestigious character. And it was all very, you know, the wokes have gone mad. But a lot of people online did have some actual good fun about it. So I'm just going to read you some of my favourite comments, right? I haven't watched a Bond movie since Timothy Dalton. This would get me back. It's quite high praise.
Very.
Another person says, I'd pay good money to see that film. Just Nish in a tux, having a breakdown and repeatedly calling the bad guy a C word for 90 minutes while the bad guy throws bread rolls at him. Very good. And then there seems to be a hashtag that was going, Nish Kumar Bond titles, with one suggestion that says, Doctor, ? No, I'm a comedian, but Mum says she's still proud of me. If anyone else has any hashtag Nish Kumar Bond titles, I would be very interested. I was having a think yesterday, From Croydon with Love. That's as far as I've got. And just really quickly, I was thinking about you as James Bond, and I promise that this does have a point. I went to a very multicultural secondary school and the teachers were always working hard to pronounce everybody's names correctly. Yeah. And I remember this time where we were in class and the white teacher was going through really proud of himself, you know, Kilvinda said it right, Jamali said it right, and then says, James, have we got James in today? He like ethnified this guy, James's name. So that's you, James Bond. Here you are. Oh, also, before we go, there's two important things we need to tell you about. The first is to announce that everyone gets a double helping of us this week.
Yes, so amongst those of you listening and watching right now, we imagine many of you have gone to the polls to exercise your right to vote in the elections taking place across England and Wales. I'm sure you've already voted. If you haven't yet, there is still time. Go now. And after that, keep your eyes peeled for an extra bonus episode from us after the election results on Friday, where we'll be analysing it all with our special guest, our good friend, Liz Bates.
And our guest for next week is the wonderful Aisling B. If you have any burning questions for her, please do send them in. You can get in touch with us by emailing psuk@reducelistening.co.uk. We really love hearing your voices, so if you're feeling brave, send us a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is 07 494 933 444. Internationally, that's +44 7494 933 444.
Don't forget to follow @PodSaveTheUK on Instagram and Twitter. You can also find us on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. Why not drop us a review if you like, but only positive.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer James Tyndale and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Video editing was by Will Darkin and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer, Alex Bennett.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
Remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can live out your MasterChef dreams when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.